Welcome to the Jersey Ontario Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Bohm. The Ontario Invitational Sale was held earlier this month, and I dare say it was another success for all buyers, sellers, and for Jersey, Ontario. The sale grossed over $180,000, with the average on 57 head coming to $3,161. We would like to thank all the volunteers, fitters, and organizers for helping put this event on. We've got a great show coming up featuring this year's Master Breeder recipients from Meadowland Farms, Thomas Kilser of Advanced Ag Systems. He will be telling us about male sterile sorghum. We will begin by hearing from Maxime Leduc and some thoughts on interpreting our forage analyses.
Joining me now is Maxime Leduc. Maxime is part-time lecturer for forage systems at Université de Québec on Abitibi-Témiscamingue, partners with various institutions and universities for research on forages, health status of dairy cows, and sheep production. Max is also the owner of the startup company Mon Système Foragère, which is a platform for the holistic management of forages from the field to the cow. Max, I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you, Rick, to invite me to your podcast. Sorry for my English. It's my beautiful French accent. It's a long time that is happy that is to help you in your podcast since we know you since the last 12 years.
Yeah, at 12 years already. Wow, it's been a while. No, your English will be great.
I think it's more 15.
Yeah, it must be getting close. I'm 34 now, so that makes about sense. Tell us what kind of a farm you grew up on.
Me, my father started a farm, like hobby farm, like a 5-cow. And with the time, we increased the size of his beef herd. And when I had 15 or 16 years old, we start sheep farming. And we bought the herd of 50 ewe. And with the time, we increase our sheep herd to 250 ewe. And those year, we have the same size of sheep farm. And we produce around 500 to 550 lamb per year.
What do you like about working with sheep?
Well, I like sheep. Yes, they are dummy. But not as dummy. They are dummy like a beef cow. But the difference between a beef cow and a sheep is a sheep, you can handle it. You can take it, drop it, and sit. But the beef cow, it's more difficult. It's to manipulating it. And if the cow try to kick you, it's hurt more than just the sheep. The sheep will never try to kick you.
Okay.
And except the ram. It's why they are more easier to manipulate, is the main reason.
So you're from Ferme-Neuve, which is a few hours north of Ottawa. How does being a bit further north affect what kind of crops you can grow relative to, say, Montreal?
Just to give you an idea, if you're talking about eat corn unit, I think you're still using that in Ontario and the rest of the Canada. It depends where you are, because Mont-Laurier, it's not a flat land. They have river. If you're near the river, it's more warm, but it's around 2,200 each unit. In some places, 200, 400 each unit. Some person are able to grow corn silage, is not an issue. Soybean is not an issue. Different of small grain is not an issue. It's just nobody doing real corn grain.
Yeah.
Possible some of them are able to try to doing it with I'm sure corn, but it's not very common. And depending on the season, at least you can do tree cut if you are very intensive in your alfalfa and you have a good, if you're able to do your first cut of forage field before the end of June, then you can take a cut of forage in your alfalfa field during the season because you have a cut every 30 to 35 days, but it's affect the survival of the alfalfa.
Right. So you did your graduate work on enriching milk and alpha linoleic acid. What is this alpha linoleic acid, and why were you interested in increasing its levels in milk?
Oh, it's far away from my PhD, like you, Eric.
Yeah.
The idea of this project is because alpha linoleic acid, it's omega-3 in other end, and it's good for the health of the human, good for the health of the cow. But the problem due to the bioregeneration in the rumen of the cow, despite the fact the forage high concentration of alpha linoleic acid and omega-3 in concentration, they have a limited amount going in the milk, due to the microbiome of the rumen. And the purpose of my PhD was to look to find strategy to increase omega-3 in the milk. To be honest, it's possible to increase at some level, but due to the metabolism of the cow and the rumen of the cow, it's kind of impossible to reach a level that it will be legally possible to label source of omega-3 in the milk that you buy at the grocery store.
So what takes you from working on enriching milk and omega-3s to working on forages?
But you need to know a PhD, undergrad study, mainly the PhD, yes, you concentrate yourself on a topic, but if you're smart, you can use your PhD as a way to learn how to work and how to think and how to develop solution and project. That is the main aspect I learned, despite the fact of my thesis topic. And I moved to forage system, first of all, because during my PhD, I was starting to be interested about forage system. I started to follow a conference in forage system for my own farm. And after a PhD, you need to find a job. It's why they have a job position that was open at Lactanet that's looking for forage specialists. During the 3 years of my PhD, yes, I improved my skill in animal nutrition, but I also improved my skill by myself in forage. It's why I start my for 2 years at Lactanet as forage specialist. And after that, I move forward to other position in university for nutrition agriculture. But why I still continue to work in forage system is just because it's the poor chill of the agriculture. Forage is an important cost of production of dairy, beef, and sheep, but mm-hmm. the producer have limited amount of tool.
Yes.
To help them to take decision compared to just managing your genetic of the cow, managing your herb, managing the elk. And that was my goal, to add to help the producer to improve their forage management and reduce the risk to grow good and cheap forage that was at the moment not available.
Right.
Because right now in the forage system, you have a lot of knowledge, like you have pamphlet, you have document, but nothing's, I will say, smart that help you, that is based on your data. And it's why I try to work on it right now, to how to use data in precision agriculture for forage system.
So you have your own startup company. Do you want to maybe take just a minute or two to quickly tell us about the aims of your startup company and what you're trying to do there?
Yeah. All the stuff about forage, like I explained, I start with Lactanet and also start with the problem I had on my farm in 2017 where I lost all my crop. And the idea of this is every step of the forage system have an impact on the dairy or the beef or the entire production. And it's where it comes from, the idea of the startup. The idea is to develop a platform that will help to manage globally the forage system. When I say globally, it's be able to integrate the data from the soil, the decision on the soil, on the crop selection, the harvest, the storage, and the feed animal, to integrate all those aspects of the cycle that normally are take separately and not connected, and to allow the producer to take global decision on the forage system and to know what is the impact of one specific vision on the entire cycle, on the milk production, the health of the cow, the profitability of the farm. And it's what they're looking for, to help the producer to make their life easier with the forage system and improve their sustainability.
Right. So it'd be some sort of a tool where I might be able to put in, for example, that I'm cutting my hay today, or I might cut my hay next week. I put in those different dates, and then it might be able to tell me what impact those different dates would have on my milk yield over the coming year.
Yeah, that is my long-term goal. I continue to apply to develop this solution. Like a digital twin, a virtual farm that you can run the simulation. But right now in a month, I will get out the first tool just to help to an interpretation of the silage analysis. That is a little bit the topic of your discussion in a couple of minutes, to help the farmer to be able to easily interpret their silage and to know if something going wrong only based on the forage analysis, and give some information what could be the cause and what could be the solution to improve the next time you don't have this problem in their forage, their silage.
Right. So when we talk about forages, what would you identify as the two most important factors in making high quality feed?
The cutting time and the conservation.
Okay, so...
And what I talk about King Time, everything is based about what is your need. Is it a 4-H for high-performing dairy cow or Jersey cow? Is it for dry cow? Is it for beef or sheep? That is your first criteria to decide, oh, what I need to do, what I need as 4-H quality. And after that, you need to figure out when you're doing your cutting management. Is it early bloom, early bloom stage, example for alfalfa, bloom stage, early flower or full flower of the plant? It's where you make sure you keep the good quality for at least for the first cut. And after that, you can make a beautiful yield, beautiful 4-H quality, a beautiful alfalfa with more than 20% of protein, less than 40% of NDF, and less than 30% of ADF. But if you do a poor job in the silo or the bale, everything, you lose all this money and this cost, and you spoil your silage, you can increase the amount of mycotoxin, and that will affect negatively your performance of your cow.
So cutting time and preservation of your silage.
Yeah.
Best management practice is to have all forage analyzed. When you get a forage analysis, what are the first three things that you look at on that forage analysis?
It depends what is your purpose. Is for to look for which animal you need to feed the cow. You're looking about the amount of energy, net energy of lactation, or they have other indicator like milk 2016 and milk 2006. They are indicator that helping, that is index, that is compute to know how many kilogram of milk is produced per ton of dry matter of 4-H. That is indicator that help you to score, and the amount of protein at least. But that is for the energy purpose. You have also other indicator related to the NDF digestibility. Other indicator that lot less in person looking for, it's about the quality of the fermentation. That is all related to the proportion of soluble protein in your silage, the pH of your silage, the amount of lactic acid, if you have presence or not of butyric acid, that are good indicator of the fermentation quality. Or another one is the crude protein bound to the ADF fiber. That is a good indicator if they have heat damage happen in your silage. Then you have two big category. One is for nutrition of your cow that's helping you to look which animal will consuming it. And the other one group is for the fermentation pattern, the quality of the fermentation that is more related. Did you do a good job during your preservation of your silage in your silo if you don't have any issue?
And those two groups relate back to those important factors that you identified in terms of cutting time and preservation of the forage. On the forage analysis,
I will just make a point on this. Other one that we don't consider is the dry matter, because the dry matter, it's another pro factor when you're doing your harvest, because if you have bad dry matter, too high dry matter, depending on the type of silo, it could lead to poor fermentation and create problem. But cutting management, the date of the cut is important for the quality of the silage, but the dry matter is also important for the fermentation quality and keeping this forage quality also.
Right. So when we look at the NDFD 24, 48 hour and NDF disappearance rate, these are two lines that we have on our forage analyses. I'm wondering, what's the difference between these and why are they important to look at?
The NDF digestibility, first of all, we need to understand what is it, the concept. NDF digestibility, how it's measured first, what you take, it's done in vitro in the lab. They take a sample of the 4-H and they let in a small bag and they put the bag in rumen juice, rumen liquid for 24 hour, 48, 30 hour, 120 or 240 hours. And what they look, it's what is the proportion of this bag disappear in the rumen. It means is the proportion of the NDF that was able to be degraded by the rumen organism. More higher is this proportion, higher is the quality of the 4-H, more energy you'll be able to have. And you have different time points. You talk about 24, 30, depending on the lab. Each lab have different receipt. It's possible to find 12, 24, 30, 48, 120. And 240. It helps you after that to identify the different pool of fiber digestibility, that is fast pool and slow pool. And the difference is done with the, depending on the lab, is between the 30 and the 48 hour. It, everything before 48 or 30 hours is the fast pool. Everything after that is the slow pool of accessible NDF that helping you to manage your ration, to know what is the availability of energy in your ration. And the concept that you talk about, the digestibility disappearance rate, is just how fast it happened. It's like the speed. The 48, right. The 24 hour, it's giving to you what is the maximum, and the rate of disappearance, it just, what is the, it's a percentage. It's like how fast it will happen in the time.
All right. And at the end of our forage analysis, close to the bottom lines, there's two different indexes that we see. We see RFQ, RFV, so relative forage quality and relative forage value, I believe, two. So how are they calculated, and what are the optimal values that we would like to see in terms of forages that we'd like to feed to our lactating cows?
First of all, I will start with relative feed value. Are the one that are the less used anymore. It's still there because it costs no extra money for a lab company to put it there, but it's the less used and the less precise, because relative feed value is composed mostly of, it's an equation between NDF and ADF.
Mm-hmm.
And also relate to an assumption and calculate on total digestible nutrient is the less important, because it integrates only two factors. NDF, ADF is the one that we try to less use. The one that is most up-to-date is the relative forage quality that integrate more factor like NDF digestibility at 30 hours, the amount of ash, the NDF, the crude protein, little bit of fat, little bit of ADF. And this equation allow you to score the quality of your forage and allow you to scoring it. And after that, you can use this indicator for to know at which animal you will feed this category. I will give some number, but it's better to go, you have guideline already, saying example between 100 and 120 of the value for relative forage quality. It's more for dairy effort between 18 and 24 months. And for cow and you not lactating. And after that, between 115 to 135, it's more beef, cow, and calf, dairy effort, younger, you with lamb. And if we're looking for milking dairy cow, high producing one, we're looking for value higher than 140. But it's possible to find table that show you what is the range. But that is only a way to compare forage. That's it. You cannot make a ration with it. It's just a way to compare the forage quality. And one advantage of the relative forage quality index is you can compare not only alfalfa, but you can compare also grass. And if you want to move a step further about using an indicator to evaluate the quality of your silage, you can either use Milk 2006. It's developed at the University of Wisconsin. That is for corn silage purpose. Or Milk 2017. That is for grass and legume. Those indicators integrate more standard forage analysis result, like digestibility of the fiber, crude protein, but give a result based on kilogram of milk per ton of dry matter that you produce. And if you're looking for, it's a more advanced indicator about if you want to rank your forage quality.
If our forage analysis doesn't have Milk 2006 or Milk 2017 on it, is it possible to go to the website and manually enter in the individual metrics from our forage analyses and then get those numbers?
Yeah, in 2 months you can take my apps because it will be automatically calculated with a simple picture of your forage analysis. But in reality, it's very open. If you go to the website of the Wisconsin University, the Forage Extension, you will find these those two Excel sheet that you just put your number, and you will be able to calculate your result. And also, if you provide the cost and the number of the yield of your field, you can calculate the number of milk per acre or hectare. Also, if you know the right. harvest yield.
Well, that's really interesting. I didn't know about that. So thank you for sharing that. Finally, I just want to look quickly at close-up rations. We feed our close-up cows something. It's a really sensitive time for the cow, and it's really the platform that launches them into lactation. And depending on how you do it, you can set them up for really good lactation or for quite an average or even a poor lactation. So what are the key values that we want to consider when we're looking at forages to base our close-up dairy cow rations on?
Okay. If we're talking, you can talk about a forage need to have five quality for close-up ration to make sure one of them is to be palatable. No mold, no... It's not because they have lower need that you need to feel moldy or spoil silage. Other than that, it can create problem because when the cow consume contaminated feed, it's the immune system that need to fight this contamination of the silage. And the energy used by the immune system is not used for the calf inside or preparation of the mammary gland. Mold-free, like I said. Yeah, you need to have a modest amount of energy or starch content. It's why you need to be careful with providing corn silage, maximum 25% of the ration if you need to feed it. Otherwise, it could create some problem. The cow can be start to be too fat and create other metabolic problem during the calving or early calving, like ketosis, or it can lead to a lot of more problem. Low amount of potassium. Lower than 2% for your forage, and high bulk for rumen field potential, because you want to limit the feed intake of the cow, because if she too much consume too much energy, it means a forage that is could be higher in with lower NDF digestibility or higher in ADF or ADF. It's where normally you try to consider more grass forage for different reason. At the exception of orchard grass, that grass that can accumulate a lot of potassium, and it's why also you don't use alfalfa, because alfalfa high concentration of potassium in the plant, in the tissue. It's why Timothy red canary grass are more suitable for this kind of forage, and it's why also you try to feed a second cut forage, not the first cut, because the first cuts are all the time higher in potassium. For in the grass is why the second cut is better. And you try to keep a field that where manure are not apply on it, because when you apply manure in grass field, yes, you want to provide nitrogen, but at the same time, some manure are in potassium because it's coming from dairy cow. And you need to be careful with that with manure application.
And potassium.
All, yeah.
And potassium is particularly interesting because of the relationship it has with incidences of milk fever, correct?
Yeah, exactly, because they tell you to, I don't know what's the version in French and English, the DCAT value, the different yes. Cation and ion. And that is why you need to doing not only near-infrared analysis in your forage, but also doing chemical analysis of the potassium, sodium, chloride, and sulfur. And if you want to, in your forage, make sure you have a low DCAT value for your forage. And also it will help you to reduce the if you want to do a ration with a negative DCAT, you need to have a forage with low potassium and low DCAT. Otherwise, you will need to add too much anionic salt in your ration, and that will reduce the palatability because it will feel sour. And it's why you need to make sure to provide a good forage quality with low DCAT value. And one way, if you're looking for doing good one, you keep only one field, red canary grass, second cut, you can apply nitrogen fertilizer because it will boost the grow and reduce the concentration of potassium. And also you can buy fertilizer with chloride that you apply with, it's a very small amount. It's like 10 kilo per hectare or 20 kilo per hectare, it's a very small amount, one time per year. and it will increase the amount of chloride in your forage and help you to have low decad value forage.
That's really interesting to hear and very insightful. Max, I know that you have another meeting that you need to go to. I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a very educational discussion, and hopefully our listeners are able to take something away from it. We tried to hammer through this pretty quickly, but thank you for joining me, and hopefully I hope that you have a good week.
Yeah, you too, Eric.
At this point, I would like to welcome Thomas and Fred Judd to the program. They operate Meadowland Farms in Simcoe and are this year's recipients of the Jersey Canada Master Breeder Award. Welcome aboard and congratulations, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Eric.
Pleased to be here.
I should note that Thomas is also our on the board for Jersey Ontario and has been on the board for 8 years, seven?
Eighth year, yes.
I wanted to take this opportunity to interview them and learn a little bit about this year's Master Breeder recipients. Tell us a little bit about your family, the history of the farm, and the story behind the Meadowland prefix.
Oh, thank you, Eric. I think we'll have my dad, Fred, give you a bit more of the history as he's lived more of it. So we'll let maybe him go first.
So my dad bought this farm with my grandfather in 1946. And at that time, the local dairy wanted higher test milk. And it was at that time that they decided they were going to milk strictly Jerseys. And so they started into a milk cooperative milking Jerseys. And that was, of course, prior to the formation of the Ontario Milk Marketing Board. And that's how we got into Jerseys. It's along the Lynn River. And so my grandmother was the one that came up with the name Meadowland. So that's where the prefix came from. And that's why we are milking Jersey cows and happy to be.
So that's 20 years before the introduction of quota, I think. If I have this right, your farm is just on the edge of Simcoe, not far from Lake Erie. What do you like best about where you guys are?
There's lots to like. Absolutely. The sandy soil is perfect for a lot of variety of vegetables as well as fruit. Norfolk County is one of the Ontario's leaders in growth of vegetables, of stone fruits, of orchard as well. Our farm, our family's actually been tried all of it throughout the years. We tried tobacco on New Year's. So it's been a wonderful place to be and to being right on the edge of Simcoe. There's lots of a large market, let's say, close by, and lots of actually school. I used to walk to school, so lots of community things that are close by, and it's a real pleasure to be where we are.
You know, I don't think I know any farm kids anymore who were still able to walk to school. So that's something. Either that or you went to school for a really long time, Thomas. How old are you?
Well, you know, it was uphill both ways, right?
So. So as I mentioned off the top, you're this year's recipients of the Master Breeder Award, which recognizes achievements in type and production over, I think, 17 year time period. Was it a specific goal of yours to maybe work towards this award?
Not of mine, certainly. I did set a goal when I came back to the farm to reach into the top five of composite breed score average in our county. And wouldn't you know it, we haven't made that yet, but we do have a master breeder shield now. So very, very, very unexpected, but wonderful all the same.
You were in Lévis, Quebec 2 weeks ago now to receive the award. What was that experience like of, you know, standing in that room and actually being presented and honored for your achievements?
What a wonderful place to be with a lot of Jersey royalty. Just can't say enough and thank you enough to Jersey Canada for providing that opportunity, and it was really wonderful to be with a lot of our Jersey family. We're part of the Brant Norfolk Golden Horseshoe Club, and it was really special. I know for me, and I think for Dad as well, to have Bruce and Carolyn Sales were there as well, who have won the Master Breeder Shield as well. So to be able to speak with them a little bit and to hear congratulations from not just all of Jersey Canada, but even those closer to home, it was really special. And also to have all of our family present for it as well. It was a long drive, but it was well worth it. And it was a great event, and we met a lot of really great Jersey people there. That's for sure.
Yeah, and it's I actually lived in Quebec City for a number of years, and the first Jersey Canada meeting that I ever went to was the one hosted in Quebec City, so just across the river from Lévis, 11 years ago, I guess. And it's a beautiful place to visit if you have an opportunity. So I'm kind of envious that you guys got to go back and visit there. But certainly you deserve it, and what a wonderful place to go to receive that recognition. Briefly, I want to ask you about your breeding strategy. And I want you to comment a little bit on sires and cow families that you identify as most important to the success that you've had.
Great, great question, Eric. There's actually, I think we're going to tackle this probably in two segments, because there was, Dad and I had a great conversation about it. And we started talking about bulls and then realized that they kind of blended. And then there was the area where I took over, and then Dad started talking about cows that I had no memory of. So I think we'll start with maybe some more foundation cows for our herd, and then we can move maybe into the transition period and maybe some of those sires. Yep. So I'll let Dad, if you wanted to start off.
So, Eric, what I found with my breeding strategy early on, I found I was going back to sires that gave us good type. That was what I was looking for, was type sires. And specifically, if I could identify any weakness in the herd that seemed to be common throughout the herd, for example, at one point I was concerned about wide front teats and perhaps a little loose front udder attachments, and I found a sire that would correct that, and I used it pretty extensively through the herd. And so what I found myself doing was breeding for type, feeding for milk and butter fat, and then culling for either for whatever was necessary at the time. If we had if one cow was really low, well, she went out. If she only classified good, they went out. And so my strategy turned out as it happened that I would breed for type, feed for milk and butter fat, and then cull for whatever it was necessary. I found that strategy worked pretty good.
What bulls?
So early on, I was going back to JFD Title when he was a young sire, and we moved on through that, through the Silver J and Silver Sequel. The one sire that I really liked that worked, seemed to work very well in our herd was Holly Lane Renaissance.
He also worked in most herds.
Yeah, I really liked Renaissance. He had some holes. There were some problems with Renaissance, but overall, I just loved those cattle. But those were the sires I worked at.
Just out of curiosity, do you know what year about Title would have been a young sire? Just
that I would think that would have been maybe in about the early to mid 70s.
Mm-hmm. Quite a while ago, that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
A little bit later, and Dad, you had mentioned Bright Spot.
Now that Medalon Bright Spot was a
Bright Spot was mid 80s.
He was a Milestones generator son. He really kicked out a lot of milk. There were a lot of cows that milked very well.
Yeah, sorry, he was in the 80s. I was just gonna say, he was in the 80s. I was actually just talking to Chris Kyle about him for something else, and I needed a little bit of a lesson, so of course I asked him, and that generator came up as a 80s sire, as a son of what, a son of who, sorry, I have it written down.
Medalon Bright Spot was a Milestones generator son,
yeah,
and
that's
so
right.
And Bright Spot was right through the early 80s. Yes.
I got looking, and usually our farm, if we find something that works, heifers, gives me a pretty good look. And I got looking back, and oh my goodness, there's about 45 or 48 daughters out of Bright Spot at one time at Meadow Lynn. So certainly.
Was that Bright Spot?
All Bright Spot. Oh, our farm certainly went through a lot of Bright Spot. But then we get into a little bit later, and really the crossover for Dad and I was kind of the turn of the century in 2003, when Legacy and Molly Buck Fusion really took over. That was a period of time where I had some influence on those cows, and really we had one year that we had 15 daughters and 15 daughters of the year, and five of them went excellent. There were a couple of years, in the 2005 range that were very good for our farm. And that was the changeover, and then I started to use Comerica, and had a show winner that I actually sold Metal in Indiana sale, actually. Later success with certainly Premier, this foundation sire, I would say.
If you were to assess your breeding strategy today, you talked about breeding for type and feeding for production, basically. Is that still applicable to your approach today?
Good question. Certainly, I think my approach was a much more balanced approach, with a focus on a much higher weighting to production. We don't have the animal constraints as we did in the old tie stall barn, so we're not calling for strict number or stall numbers now. And now with the robot, it's all hands forward on the milk production side. So that it means it's even more critical that The cows that we do, that I do cast for type, that they do fit the bill. So it's probably a more balanced approach than it was maybe in our tie stall. And that was really the catalyst, was, the change from the tie stall barn to our, compost, pack, barn. That probably, was probably the largest, change, in that we were now breeding for more production than we were for type.
How long have you been in the new barn?
Our new barn is 10 years now, basically. 10 years we added on to it in 2017. And we added a robot, and switched out the parlor, last year. So, I've now managed all three, from a tie stall to a parlor to a robot. So, still learning every day.
Yeah. Good for you. That's great. So your family opens up the farm every spring to the community for a special event. And I want you to tell the listeners a little bit about this, because I think it's super neat.
Oh, our Who Let the Cows Out event.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you. Yeah, it came about because Dad and I usually talked every year. When we got to see in the old tie stall barn, we'd watch the cows open up the gate, and we played a game early on that whoever could guess the old cow that was going to lead everybody into the pasture for the first time, and that was a great game to play. But once again, how do we build that? How do we create that feeling and extend that feeling to our
commercialize it?
Well, how do we? Yeah. Yes. How do we commercialize it, Dad? But how do we extend that feeling and share that feeling with our community? So I had the idea of videotaping it and maybe putting it up on YouTube. And then my wife, Sarah, said, well, why we have this, her new community supported agriculture program gets and supports a number of families throughout the vegetable growing season. So why wouldn't we get or allow them to come watch on the farm if necessary? So that's kind of where it started, let's let some people come onto the farm and kind of show really one of the best days, and show them what it's all about. And it was only really then that I started to research it and realize that it's very much a Swiss or Scandinavian tradition to take the animals up to pasture. And so it's quite the event through those countries. We're up to probably 100 or so people every year. They get to come on farm and see the cows kick up their heels for a salt, and then we go have some food.
That's great. I love the idea, and I think that it's wonderful that you're able to incorporate the community into what is probably one of the more joyous days of the year up until they go through the fence, because watching cows get out after winter is definitely... Yeah, it definitely puts a smile on everybody's face.
Especially jerseys, right, Eric? Especially jerseys.
Yeah. You talked earlier about how you guys have tried everything from, you know, tobacco to various fruits. Coming into this summer, what are the other revenue streams on your farm aside from the dairy?
So I'll speak for milk sales and animal sales, but I'll also touch on Sarah, my wife's veggie box program. Every week for 20 weeks, we're down to 18 weeks, just to keep our sanity. It's a lot of produce. It goes through. We have two 20 by 100 greenhouses, and we've got an acre and a half in intensive vegetable production, and it's a very very decent and very rewarding revenue stream for my wife and for our farm. And maybe Dad, you could talk about the strawberries.
So the strawberries, my wife and I, when we were first married, we started into a pick your own strawberry operation. Since then we've switched over to about 50-50, the picked, that's sold on farm. As you mentioned, we're right beside the town of Simcoe, so it's a captive audience. And we continue to sell a certain amount through Pick Your Own. And we're seeing a real rejuvenation now of Pick Your Own customers, in that families are now coming out, and it's not so much a cheaper way of selling fruit, but an opportunity for families to come out and enjoy the outdoors, sunshine, and teach their kids a little bit about agriculture. As well, of course, we grow all of our own feed for the cows, and we do have some cash crop, although it's not an extensive part of our operation. We still do sell corn and beans.
That's really neat that the...
Well, that's the extent of
Eric,
our operation.
Sorry, Eric, to add to our strawberry side, even now we're trying to educate the public, because we've had a number of the public come on farm now to ask where the strawberry trees are.
Oh,
so
no.
So it's pretty amazing, just to experience, to see the lack of knowledge on agriculture. Even though there's lots of opportunities very close by to Simcoe. So we get asked about our blueberry operation regularly, even though we don't have blueberries.
Well, I was going to say, I didn't know you were growing blueberries.
It's a blessing and a curse to be on the phone sometimes. So... being one of the top Google searches is a blessing and a curse. So
the one thing that I'm curious about, when people come to the farm to pick their strawberries or pick them up, is the strawberry patch close to where the dairy is as well? Like, do people see the calves or the heifers or the cows out on pasture when they come into the yard to get their strawberries?
Yes, it so happens that the pasture field is right beside the pick your own strawberry field, and we often have people reaching over the fence and petting the calves. And I guess you'd suggest that it's kind of a bucolic scene when they drive in the driveway. And we've been told a number of times that they really enjoy our pick your own place, because it's private and the cattle are visible, and it's kind of a nice spot.
Sounds like a real experience. Guys, thank you so much for joining me today. Congratulations again on the recognition of being Canada's Master Breeder for 2023. I wish you all the best in the coming growing season with the crops and the cows, but also with your fruits and vegetables.
Thank you very much, Eric. We've enjoyed speaking with you.
Thanks for having us on, Eric.
All right, so joining us now is Tom Kilser. Tom worked as an extension specialist for Cornell University for 34 years and has been working as a private consultant for the past 14 years. His career has focused on forage and plant nutrition research, and he has been publishing a long-running newsletter for farmers and industry partners to keep us abreast of his findings. I have invited him today to tell us about his work with male sterile BMR sorter. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about yourself and also about your motivation for engaging in forage crop research and the extension work that you've been doing.
Well, I grew up on a dairy farm and understand the whole concept. I'm an agronomist, but I also worked in dairy rations. So I understand the holistic approach to the farm, and that is driven by the quality and profitability of the forage produced. And so that's where most of my work has been for the 30-some years, is producing high-quality forage.
So you've recently completed trials looking at male sterile BMR sorghum. Can you briefly explain exactly what male sterile BMR sorghum is and what the interest was in studying it?
Yes, male sterile sorghum is very similar to a beef steer. It's a non-fertile plant. It will, as long as there isn't any other inoculant in the neighborhood, sorghum sedan. And because it doesn't produce a seed head, all the photosynthetic products end up going into the forage rather than into the seed. The seed is very hard, and so goes right through the cow and out the back end. It's similar to what they first started processing corn, but you can't process sorghum seeds because they're so small you would turn the crop into soup. But that was all nutrition that was being lost. And so we came up with the concept of why have that if we can put it into the plant itself. And that's what got us started on it.
Okay. And in the newsletter that you published last month, you said that you've delayed harvest by 6 to 8 weeks after heading. What effect did that have on the nutritional value of the crop? And what's the explanation for this change?
It's a very simple explanation. When corn tassels, 8 weeks later, we chop sorghum heads out. We give it a week and chop it and then complain because it doesn't have the energy and too wet a feed. So we just started treating sorghum just like corn, but without the seed heads on it. And our dry matter increased 50 to 60% in the time frame. Our non-fiber carbohydrates and non-structural carbohydrates both increased. Non-structural carbohydrates increased 200%. The non-fiber carbohydrates increased 84%. So in other words, we enhanced the nutrition of the forage, and that is all in the plant cells. It's the forage cells. It's not in any grain.
So I want to come back a little bit to the yield side in a minute. I just first wanted to get some clarity that when did you plant the crop? What was your seeding rate? What was the length of time between planting and harvest?
All right. We planted after haylage. It does not like cold soil. It used to be above 60 degrees Fahrenheit. 65 is where we prefer. Weather forecast for next week better be warm so that the stuff gets up and grows. It is a tropical plant. Just like corn is. So we plant it after our haylage is all done, which is kind of nice. We also got into this crop because we double crop with winter triticale, and it works out very nice. It fits winter triticale actually better than corn does. And so that was one of the reasons we went into it. We'll plant it here. We'll plant it up in New York the first, maybe second week in June.
Okay.
When we put it in, a key point is how long from then until it heads out, because we need 8 weeks after heading in order to get it to that nutrient enhanced state. And
right.
We're working with the plant breeders full tilt right now to develop short season varieties to fit upper U.S. and lower Canada farm. There is one company has one variety, but there is more work needs to be done. The other question you had is planting it. It's
yes.
Critical that you don't plant it over 8 pounds of seed per acre. If you do, it's going to go down on you. That's been a problem. Both the guys that sell seed and the farmers think they're going to get higher yield by increased seeding rate, and it all goes flat on. Whereas if you planted at 8 pounds and we're seriously looking at 6 to 7 pounds of seed per acre, drilled in narrow rows gives us a very good uniform crop that's going to stand through the season and stand that 8 weeks without falling down.
So you're running this through a no-till planter on 7.5-inch rows?
Yes, we're planting on 7.5-inch rows. One of the things that we do recommend is change the tubes on the drills. The tubes on the drills are accordion type that catches the seed and then dumps it in piles. The piles come up, they're all weak, and they knock each other over, and then they start knocking the good forage over. When we went to sleeve tubes, there's a company that makes sleeve tubes for the drills. We put sleeve tubes on. It's much more uniform stand and eliminates that problem. It's also a benefit when we're using the same drill to plant our winter forage. It gives us a much more uniform stand.
That's very interesting. I hadn't considered that problem before, but it's a very reasonable idea.
Well, that's my job, is to make the mistakes so you don't have to. So it makes me a professional screw up. I make the mistakes so you don't have to.
So going back to the yield side, how did the crop yield, and how did the yield of this sorghum compare to corn silage?
The latter part I can answer pretty clearly, because we've been running yield trials with sorghums, including male sterile sorghum, up at Miner Institute, which is at Chazy, New York, which is an hour and a half south of Montreal, right up against the Canadian border. And interestingly, Cornell was running corn silage trial right next to it. I mean, literally right next to it. Our yields, our average yields, exceeded the highest yields of corn. And our yields are much better than the corn on a pretty consistent basis. The only time it would go off is if we had a very cold, wet summer. But other than that, under normal conditions, sorghum equals or exceeds the corn silage in yield. We did not check yield down here, our Pennsylvania site, simply because we were so focused on determining the feed quality over time that that's all we focused on.
Okay, so in terms of fertilization, how do the fertilization programs compare between sorghum and corn? And what's the seed cost is always of interest as well.
Well, the seed cost is interesting. Corn today is about U.S. about $180 an acre. Sorghum is $20 an acre. Yes, but you have to buy your own hat. You got to get your own jacket. You got to get your own pen. But the seed is a whole lot cheaper than it is for corn. Fertilization at this point is very similar to corn, except for nitrogen. Nitrogen, we are looking at putting in a replicated two-year nitrogen trial in New York, right not far from you, over across Buffalo. In that part of New York State, because sorghum is 11% crude protein, it's not 8% like corn silage, if there is enough nitrogen and sulfur late into the season. But okay, that's where manure works very well. Injected manure, the organic matter is releasing much later into the season, and so it works out well to supply it. If you have enough nitrogen, then we have 11%, 12% food protein forage, which saves a lot of money on soybean.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, 3 or 4% difference in the diet adds up, especially if the diet is, you know, primarily composed of, say, corn silage versus sorghum. Mm-hmm. So on in terms of feeding our cows with this male sterile BMR sorghum, what are your recommendations on that side?
The number one recommendation is that you print off and you state on the forehead of your nutritionist that sorghum is not corn silage. They insist on pulling out corn silage, throwing in sorghum. And I work with Dr. Larry Chase, Professor Emeritus of Nutrition at Dairy Nutrition Cornell. He runs it through the CNCPS model. And I asked him to pull out corn silage and throw in sorghum. We were milking, and it was balanced for an 85-pound cow. The best we could do was 77 pounds of the sorghum. He rebalanced the ration, increased the forage feeding, increased the NDF feeding levels, and for just like a pound of grain or a half pound more cornmeal grain added, he had the same milk as corn silage. But the nutritionists need to rebalance the ration. As one farmer who was growing sorghum said, his nutritionist didn't know how to feed it and didn't want to learn. But you have some good nutritionists up in your area, and they are getting onto this very quickly.
So if we have a ration of
say 60% corn silage, and we take the corn silage out as our primary energy source and replace it with sorghum, where ballpark sorghum would then make up what percentage of a similar diet?
It could replace corn silage. It has the energy. When we ran the energy numbers, it can replace corn silage. An added bonus is that corn silage is 2 to 4% sugar. Sorghum, male sterile sorghum with enhanced nutrition, is 26% sugar on a dry matter basis. When you put more sugar into the diet, it increases components. You put more sugar into the diet, the fungi that break down fiber capitalize on that sugar and can break down more of the fiber, so it enhances the digestion. Now, when they tried to add sugar to dairy diets, they had acidosis because they basically poured sugar in and it goes right to the bottom of the rumen and forms an acidotic pool. In this case, the sugar is enclosed in each little plant cell. And so the fungi break each little plant cell and slowly release the sugar out of those cells. So you have a steady flow of sugar going into the rumen, maintaining high pH, which gets rid of subclinical acidosis and maintains good component form.
Right, and that's a really important point, is that it's slowly released, right, to avoid the acidosis with those high sugar diets. Finally, if you're trying to convince a producer, why should they consider sorghum as a forage source instead of corn silage?
Several reasons. First is we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket. By growing corn and by growing sorghum, you get a hot, dry year, the sorghum is going to come through for you. You get a cold, wet year, the corn is going to come through for you. You put the two crops into the ration, you're going to balance out very nicely the higher sugars in the sorghum and the higher starch in the corn, and balance very nicely on those two. Sorghum will eliminate corn rootworm. You grow 1 year of sorghum, there is no corn rootworm in that field for the next year or two. Deer like to hide in sorghum and come out and eat the neighbor's corn. For that end, it works very well. We are going to be testing it in a site that has a high bear population. We are really nervous about what happens with bear get because of the high sugar. those are pieces that have worked well. It also allows us then to take triticale off, and get our haylage off, and then plant our sorghum. It balances the workload on the farm.
Yeah, and that's often the struggle, right, is that you end up with a lot of crops coming off but in similar time periods with similar sensitivity for how quickly they need to be done.
They all have to be done today.
Yeah. This has been really interesting. I really want to thank you for coming on the show and sharing what you've found out about male sterile sorghum. I know that for us, when we read your newsletter, it really made us think about our approach to growing energy forages on our farm. And we're definitely going to consider this. So this has been very illuminating. And I just, thank you again for coming on.
Well, the main thing is make sure you get the right variety. It needs to fit your climate zone. And we're working on that with breeders.
Wonderful. Tom, thank you very much. Have a good weekend.
You're welcome. You too. Take care.
Well, we've reached the end for this month's episode. If you enjoyed this show, please share it with one or two friends. You can also reach out to us and share your thoughts or provide suggestions on future topics by emailing jerseyontariopodcast@gmail.com. That's jerseyontariopodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Next month, we welcome Daniel Rico, and we'll have a chat about heat stress. So long for now.